I call this meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order and note that a quorum is present. So members, the first order of business today will be a overview hearing from Commissioner Showalter from Minnesota Management of Budget around the budget and the economic forecast. And then after that, we will be taking up House File 35. So with that, we will just get right down to business. So I welcome Commissioner Showalter to the committee. So if you'd like to come up and introduce yourself for the record. And I know we're kind of rushed. We had session, we had rules, and so I appreciate you kind of flexing with us today, Commissioner.
It's all good. Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. With me today is Anna Menge, who's the State Budget Director, and Laura Kalibakitis. Dr. Laura Kalibakitis is on her way, and hopefully will be joining us shortly. I'm really pleased to sort of give you a walkthrough of the budget and economic forecast. And so I'm just going to give you a little bit of background before we even start going into the substance of the forecast. As this committee well knows, Minnesota's got a great discipline of providing a set of information for everyone to work on. But we have two forecasts every year, one in November, late November, early December, a second one in late February. That provides an updated set of information on revenues that have been collected, national economic forecast information that we can incorporate into models, both at the Department of Revenue and on the spending side, and put it all together so that you have a snapshot, both prior to sort of that end of year kind of Christmas sales and tax filings, and then finally an update so that you have additional information in the midst of session to understand where the latest economic outlook is. Minnesota's discipline is really remarkable. It's one of the reasons why Minnesota's a AAA state, is that we have a very solid and a very consistent way of looking at our budget outlook. I want to thank, you know, just our fantastic team at MMB, state agencies, as well as legislative staff for the work that goes into this. It is definitely a team effort. And while the three of us are presenting it, there's many people, Chair, who are contributing to it. With that, let's just point out where we're at, if I do this correctly. The state budget outlook is strong. We have had a series of monthly revenue updates that have been positive. And what this forecast does is roll those in and give us a better outlook and understanding of where we're at. For fiscal years 22 and 23, we're expected to close with about $5 billion more than previously estimated. For many of you, that won't be a total surprise because on those monthly revenue updates, we do on the 10th of every month. We had reported in a number of times that we're $2 to $3 billion running ahead of expectations. What this forecast did was not only looked at those, but also that there were expenditure savings that were anticipated for that 22 and 23 biennium that were added to that. The longer-term outlook is just as important, though. And that is where we looked at 24 and 25, and we knew leaving last session that we were in a pretty positive place. That got a little bit more positive, plus the balance that was coming forward from previous years gets us to the $18 billion. Now, this is all obviously very good news. It's historic types of numbers, but one of the key messages of this forecast is there are economic headwinds coming, that even amidst this, we're looking at the potential for economic slowdown and the potential for a recession coming in the coming months. So the couple of things in 24-25 that I want to highlight, just that the income growth reduces, is lower income growth, and it'll show up in the revenue numbers I'll show you in a second, and lower health care costs, which save the general fund money. Structural balance is something we look at a lot. Just on an annual basis, how are we comparing how much comes in versus how much is spent? We're anticipating that to be positive throughout the forecast horizon. But those headwinds that I mentioned are really the focus of that last bullet, and Dr. Kalibakitis will walk through some of that information. This graphic gives you a sense of what we're looking at. Because of the end of session numbers were substantial, that we still had a sizable carry forward going into this budget. The change in this forecast is really about $6 billion in change in new numbers. You see that we've moved from about $5 billion to about $6 billion in that structural number, and that carry forward, the amount coming from previous years, grew substantially. So we started basically not from zero. It's not that $18 billion showed up, but that, in fact, our position, our starting point, was already substantial because we didn't spend down to zero at the end of the last legislative session. This gives you the numbers version of that. What you see is the beginning balance, and this is going to be a format that you're all going to get very familiar with if you're not already. So on the left side is the 22 and 23 biennium. You'll see that the November forecast, that left-hand column, starts with a beginning balance of $7 billion. So that's where we went into last session and came through at the end of the day with a budgetary balance of $11 billion. That after you add in the revenues, the spending, the budget reserve, and how much forecast change occurred in that 22-23 biennium. So I talked about the current year's getting better. You'll see there $3.3 billion in revenues improvement in what we were looking at in 22 and 23, and savings in lower spending estimates of $1.5 billion, getting to that $5 billion improvement in the current biennium. Some of that also went into the budget reserve. I'll note there that you see $196 million improvement in the budget reserve. That's based upon current statute. The whole forecast is based on statute, and the reserve is set by a recommendation on the volatility, and we can go into that a little bit more later. The right-hand side shows you the 24 and 25, showing the beginning balance where we had an improved balance carrying from 22 and 23, but much smaller changes in revenues and spending. That's really a couple of things. One is the impact of some of those headwinds that we're going to be talking about, as well as some of the one-time nature of the spending reductions, because the federal help from peacetime emergency and public health emergency are expected to end by the time we get into 24 and 25. Roll all that together, you'll see that the budgetary balance improves over that period. So that is kind of the top level set of information. Chair Olson, is there any introductory comments or questions before we go further?
Commissioner Showalter, I don't see anything, and we'll just note maybe between you're going to have, we'll have other folks from the agency come up, but we'll have questions as members have them. We'll take them maybe after the presentation, if that works for all of you. So we'll continue then. So thank you, Commissioner.
Very good. Thank you, Chair. Since Dr. Kolumbakidis isn't here at the moment, I'm going to skip ahead a couple sections, and we're going to go into the spending and long-term budget outlook, and introduce State Budget Director Anna Mingi.
Welcome, Ms. Mingi, to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Anna Mingi, State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. So I'll be walking through changes in the state expenditure forecast since the end of session, as well as some of our long-term budget outlook. So the first slide you see outlines changes in general fund spending in the current biennium, 22-23, as well as anticipated changes in the upcoming budget biennium. Overall, spending changes are a significant part of the forecast story, with the November forecast, though still when looking at them compared to overall general fund spending, less than 3% in the current biennium and about 1% lower in the next biennium. So I'll start by looking at changes in the current biennium fit under the column labeled fiscal year 2022-23. So E-12 education spending is the largest share of the general fund budget, and it's projected to reach $20.2 billion this biennium. This is actually $280 million lower than previous estimates, primarily as a result of fewer than expected pupils, which I'll discuss in greater detail in a later slide. Moving to the next line, you'll see that health and human services spending is about $1.1 billion below end of session estimates. And this is largely the result of additional federal funds for Medicaid resulting from the extension of the federal public health emergency. I also will talk about that in a little more detail later in my presentation. The savings in this number, that $1.1 billion, also include a few other items, such as higher anticipated rebate payments from prescription drug manufacturers serving medical assistance beneficiaries, and lower than expected managed care rates. Moving to the next line, you'll see that property tax aids and credit spending is relatively unchanged, and that spending for debt service is about $43 million, or 3.6% lower than previous estimates. This is the result of slower spending on currently authorized bonding projects, which resulted in a smaller bond sale in the summer of 2022. All other areas of the state budget are a combined $89 million below previous estimates. And this might look like a big number, that this line, we don't normally see changes of this magnitude. But I want to just share that this isn't actually lower spending. It's really the result of spending moving across lines in our financial statements. In the previous legislative session, the legislature appropriated $190 million to MMB for COVID management costs. And as those funds have been allocated to state agencies, primarily the Department of Health, you've seen the moving from the state government area of our financial statements into the Health and Human Services area. So that's why there's a net reduction in the all other area. It's not really lower spending, just movement across lines. So you'll see in the current biennium, total spending is forecast to be $51.8 billion, about $1.5 billion lower than end of session estimates. So if you move to the next biennium, the budget biennium, total spending is forecast to reach almost $54 billion. E12 forecast spending is relatively unchanged, and this might sound surprising given the significant savings in the current biennium. And what's occurring here is really two offsetting changes. So the savings from fewer pupils continues into the budget years. However, those are offset by increases in projected spending for compensatory education revenue. The compensatory aid estimates are above previous forecasts as a result of fewer or more children qualifying for free and reduced price school lunch, resulting from the administration's participation in a federal demonstration project for direct certification through medical assistance. So the number of students receiving and participating in the free and reduced price school meals program is the driver of payments to districts for compensatory aid revenue. And so as more students move onto that program, so too do the payments to districts increase. So the next line, Health and Human Services spending, you'll see total spending is forecast to reach almost $18 billion in the next biennium. This is a reduction of $722 million, or 3.9% from previous estimates. The largest driver of this change is no longer a story about the federal public health emergency. It's actually largely driven by lower than expected managed care rates paid to managed care organizations serving our medical assistance population. In every eligibility category, so we think of adults without kids, families with children, people with disabilities, and older adults, our actual rates in calendar year 2023 came in lower than the forecast had projected. In the next line, property tax aids and credits are forecast to be $130 million, or 3% higher than prior estimates. This change is a result of higher property tax refunds. Because property values have grown faster than household incomes, we project higher payments across a variety of refund types, including homestead credit refunds, renters' property tax refunds, and special property tax refunds. You'll see that spending on debt service and all other areas of the state budget are also relatively unchanged, but that adds up to a total spending reduction of about $600 million in the 24-25 biennium. So now I want to dive in a little deeper on the pupil reduction that I mentioned. So a significant change in the expenditure forecast was a reduction in projected pupil counts, which drives lower spending on E12 education. As I discussed on the previous slide, this forecast reflects fewer projected pupils. And this chart shows a 20-year view of actual and projected pupil counts with the forecast period sort of in the expanded chart. And so although the reduction in pupils is relatively small, about 1.5%, it drives significant reduction in state spending. So the Minnesota Department of Education uses near-term growth trends based on historical data and other factors to project pupils. And preliminary data for the 2021 through 2022 school year shows that we had about 1.4% fewer pupils than we previously expected. And because of that lower actual data, it lowers the base from which we project growth in future years, which results in that downward shift from the dotted line, which was our end of session and February estimate, down to the solid line in the chart, which is our new November forecast estimates. In addition to the reduction from the previous forecast, you can also see on this chart just a slow year-over-year reduction in pupils. And this is driven, and this is not a new trend, but just by slowing birth rates in Minnesota. And as a result of fewer births to Minnesota residents in recent years, because births correlate to the number of kids showing up for early childhood services and kindergarten enrollments in future years. We have seen that birth counts have been on a downward trend since 2014. So moving to the next slide, I wanted to provide a little additional conversation around the impact to the state budget as a result of the extension of the federal public health emergency. As a part of the federal Families First Coronavirus Response Act, the state receives an additional 6.2% federal match on medical assistance for each calendar quarter in which there's at least one day of an active federal public health emergency related to COVID-19. Since March of 2020, the state has benefited from over $2.6 billion in additional federal funds. This chart breaks apart the impacts of three quarters worth of extensions, which was the what we picked up in the November forecast from the February forecast to the state budget against the current biennium and the next. So our previous forecast assumed the public health emergency would expire in April of 2022. However, since then, the Federal Secretary of HHS has issued three 90-day extensions. And now our current forecast assumes the state will receive this additional federal match through March of 2023. And those three additional calendar quarters provide an additional $762 million in federal match, which is a savings to the state budget. But in order to receive that additional match, the state has to provide continuous coverage to medical assistance enrollees, which means that individuals aren't removed from coverage except in limited circumstances. This has the result of increasing enrollment and thus increasing costs to the state budget. But after the end of the public health emergency, the state, the Department of Human Services will renew the eligibility from all current enrollees, which will take approximately 14 months. So you'll see the net impact of the public health emergency extensions from February to November is a reduction of $603 million when you account for the additional revenue offset by those additional costs in the current biennium, but some of the higher caseload continues into 24 and 25, so there's a net cost of about $100 million in 24 and 25. But when you look across the two biennia, it results in a state savings of about $500 million. But just know that those are really one-time savings and are concentrated in the current biennium. Do you want, no, this is good.
Should we? Chair Olson, if it's all right, we're going to pause. We're going to switch and get back to the economy and revenue story, if that's appropriate.
That sounds great, Commissioner. But before you step down, State Budget Director, I do have a question if folks have a question for Ms. Mingy, we'll do that now before she steps down, and then we'll hear from Dr. Kalmakidis. So, Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a really quick clarification question that I had for Ms. Mingy. Ms. Mingy, when you were talking about this slide with, at the top, it has HHS and E12 drives lower spending. You were talking about the Health and Human Services line. You're talking about rates being less than expected. And I just wanted to clarify, because I don't think the rate, did you mean, when I think of rates, I think of payment rates, and were you talking about people rates, like eligibility, or people going on the program, or were you actually talking about reduction in what the state pays to the MCOs.
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. So what I'm speaking about is our managed care capitation payments that were negotiated for calendar year 2023 were lower than the forecast assumed that they would be, because this forecast assumed a certain amount of growth, and when the actual rates were finalized, they came in lower than the forecast had assumed.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Mingy, I had two questions. One on the school enrollment piece, and what in actual numbers has been the decline? I know you said 1.4, and so what in terms of actual numbers of pupils would that be?
Representative Mingy, or State
Budget Director Mingy. Madam Chair, Representative, it's depending on the year, it's between 12 and 14,000 pupils in the change from the previous forecast to November.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you. And then my other question is, with on the slide, the public health emergency extension, lower state spending, and you said that they have to our program has to continue in order to get the federal dollars. Are people still being required to fill out the qualifying paperwork for that, or we just put them on autopilot? What does that look like?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, the Department of Human Services must maintain continuous coverage, so individuals are by and large not going through the normal renewal processes, because with a few exceptions that sort of if someone requests to be removed from coverage or moves out of state or passes away, then they come off of the program. But our standard eligibility processes are very different. Or right now we're not sort of relying on some of the standard eligibility processes, which is why once the public health emergency ends, it will take a period of time to transition back to normal. And I know the Department of Human Services probably has a lot more detailed information on sort of what that will look like.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so basically what we're saying is these people, they could have tripled their income and they're still going to get this benefit without any qualification requirements. So thank you.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Chair Olson. And to the testifier, previously, when COVID got started, we attributed our declines in enrollment in our K-12 schools primarily to those who were starting kindergarten, that parents were choosing to delay the beginning of their K-12 education, so they were making that choice. I see the demographic references in the presentation, but it would seem to me when it comes to K-12 education, we've got a pretty good idea who should be showing up 5 years in advance, unless there's a we don't have instant kids just created. Does this data seem to point that increasing numbers or unexpected numbers of Minnesotans are choosing to opt out of our public school system?
Ms. Fingy.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I think the data does show, and you can see on the chart, that the previous forecast anticipated more students returning to public schools, sort of a larger recovery from COVID than has materialized. I think there will be some time to see long term how this recovery looks, but there is clearly the recovery post COVID hasn't materialized the way that the department projected.
Representative Grapple.
And Madam Chair, and to the testifier, obviously different parts of our state are impacted differently. Expected demographic declines, but one of the things that's out of the ordinary is some areas where we're seeing an increase in the number of school-age children, we're seeing local school districts actually have declining enrollment. That would seem to point again towards the idea of some districts there are people are opting out of the system or at a minimum choosing to send their kids to other schools. Is there any guidance or thoughts on why people are choosing to make these choices? Why are we seeing communities that have growing demographics, growing numbers of schools, or growing numbers of kids experiencing declining enrollment, or in fact just opting out of the K-12 system, the public K-12
system? Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have, and the Department of Education does track enrollment in public schools, private schools, and homeschooling. Last year, we did see an increase in private school enrollment, but a decrease in homeschooling and public school enrollment was relatively flat. I think my team can work with the department to follow up and provide you some of that additional data, if that would be useful.
Representative Graff.
My last question is, again, a lot of this data is overlaid over domestic migration data. So we've seen the last 2 years that now, on a macro basis, Minnesota is now in the top 10 states of negative domestic migration. I think there was, I think the most recent report in December was, I think some of us were expecting to see that number turn around, and in fact it accelerated. From your guys' department, do you guys, is there any tracking of that? Do you get related to that issue of, again, we're now in the top 10 of negative domestic migration. Is that part of the student pupil count driver issue?
No. Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, I'm not, so the model that projects pupils maybe is likely picking some of that up implicitly in the analysis, but I would want to work with the department to get you a clearer response on that. And I think Dr. Kolumbakidis can probably speak more to the overall trends that the state's experiencing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, just a couple of questions, similar vein to Representative Garofalo, but in the numbers that we have here with the E-12 education, do you have the conversations or do you have the ability to break those numbers down by counties and geographic disparities? Because we're going to hear a bill later today about the pegging this to the CPI, but all regions are different in Minnesota. I mean, we can have regions that experience that differently. So could we, or have you broken that down by regions and how they're faring economically with those disparities?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not, I know that the Department of Education does a lot of analysis at a sort of a lower level by geographic area. I'm not sure what's available for this forecast, but we can talk to the department and follow up with you.
Representative Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And further on that line of thought, it'd be interesting to break that down as well as the disparities in funding. And we see, because of the compensatory, and we see the way students are categorized, that there's large disparities of that that may not track, in fact, would probably not parallel those economic disparities around the region. So it'd be interesting to see those numbers as well. Would that be something that could be done or presented back to this committee?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, I'll talk with the Department of Education to see what they might be able to do. I'm sure they can put together some information that could at least try to get at what you're trying to answer.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then one final follow-up. The other data point that I think would be interesting, when we look at education and we look at the three-tiered system of how we fund it, property taxes. We have 87 counties, and we're seeing these spikes all over the place of valuations of property taxes. I would like to see some type of comparison of, we look at our E-12 funding, how that's relating to property taxes going up and down in certain counties, as well as the economic disparities that can contribute to that, because then I think we can start to tie that back to educational achievement and start to look at how those resources are being allocated. So if the department could look at something like that and present that back, I'd be very interested to see that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to follow up on the continuous coverage for eligibility under the medical assistance. Knowing that the Federal Consolidated Appropriation Act of 2023 discontinued the connection between the PHI and also the eligibility issue, whereby states are now required to start transitioning people effective April 1, so we can do the redetermination on that. Likewise, there were conditions set for additional enhanced FMAP, starting, you know, with 5% beyond the first quarter, and then 2.5 and 1.5. Are we taking that into account, and how the budget will be shifting based on that conversation?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative, so that that is something that our team is definitely tracking, and we don't have that. The impacts of the recent appropriations bill reflected in this forecast, but it will show up in February. But certainly, and thank you for raising that. As I was reading my testimony, I meant to mention that this has that the recent federal appropriations law has changed, you know, the public health emergency and these continuous coverage provisions and provide sort of an off-ramp in terms of that additional federal match as we begin our standard renewal processes.
Representative Knorr.
Madam Chair, I just want also to follow up on the pharmacy rebates.
Mm-hmm.
The Drug Formulary Committee is expiring by June, and we may not see those reserves if we discontinue. Are we tracking that in a way to look forward into the focus?
Ms. Mingy.
Madam Chair, Representative Knorr, we are. So the this forecast accounts for the fact that the Drug Formulary Committee is sunsetting under current law, and as a result, there are some supplemental pharmacy rebates that the forecast assumes we will not be receiving past the expiration of that formulary committee. So that was a cost to the forecast, I believe, in the tails, and we can follow up with the exact numbers on that if it's useful. So to the extent that that provision is extended, it would generate additional savings to the state budget.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Ms. Mingy. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we have one more member on the list for a question for the State Budget Director, and then we do have Dr. Kalmakidis here, so we'll proceed with her testimony, and then we'll go back to member questions for the full of the group after that. So, Representative Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe I'll just wait. A lot of the questions around the school pupil count, the state demographer had given a really great presentation that I watched in the other body about who our students are and where they're going. But in general, people are just not having as many babies in Minnesota is the big part. And with the direct, the net loss in migration, it's from what I've seen in the numbers, it's 18 to 25-year-olds. So it behooves us to make sure we're getting those people to come back here to work. I'll wait until the rest of the presentation. Thank you.
Can we just hit that point quickly?
Hold on, Representative Garofalo. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Is that so? I understand how when we have lower birth rates, we have these planning numbers, but those babies were created 5 years ago. So that really wouldn't explain why the February forecast and the November forecast would impact our K-12 enrollment numbers in terms of lower birth rates. It would explain why 4 and 5 years out they're going to be, but why would K-12 enrollment numbers be lower because of anticipated birth rates right now? Why would there be a change from last spring compared to November?
So, Representative Grapple, we're actually going to pause on that, the back and forth here, and we're going to get back to the presentation here. But I did hear Ms. Mingy say that the MMB would check in with the Department of Education. It sounds like the state demographer, could bring some of that information to bear that's beyond probably the scope of exactly what we're talking about. So we'll come back to that at a different time in a different way. But I do want to make sure we have time for Dr. Kalmakidis. So thank you, Ms. Mingy.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Kalmakidis. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. I'm Laura Kalmakidis, a state economist, and I apologize for being late and for the confusion of switching up the presentation. So I'm going to start with the U.S. economic outlook because Minnesota's economy is closely tied to that and how that changed from our last February forecast to November. Then I'm going to talk some about Minnesota's economy, and I'm going to turn to details of the new revenue forecast. And then I'll end by reiterating some of the risks to the forecast. So since our forecast was prepared in February of 22, the global and U.S. economies saw dramatic changes. So recall that we released our February forecast at the end of February, and based on a U.S. economic outlook that was released in the first week of February, a lot happened between the beginning and end of February. Those included that includes the Russian invasion of Ukraine, spikes in inflation, and then since then, six Federal Reserve actions to raise interest rates. Since then, even, there's been one more. As a result of these factors, the outlook for U.S. real GDP weakened between February and November. Our macroeconomic consultant, IHS, as of their November outlook, expects tighter financial conditions to weaken investment in interest rate-sensitive sectors, in particular housing, inducing a mild three-quarter investment-driven recession beginning at the end of 22. Now, since then, they have released two more outlooks, and so as I go through, I'll give you a little bit of an update of those outlooks. But the basic story, the difference between their November outlook and what they're saying now as of January, they're still expecting a mild recession. They just moved it forward, and so it didn't start, obviously, at the end of 22, and they're expecting two quarters of contraction or negative GDP growth in the first two quarters of this year, 23. So in the first chart, we're showing the IHS forecast for annual growth in U.S. real GDP. The light bars show IHS's February 22 forecast. The dark bars show the history and the November 22 forecast. IHS expected annual real GDP to grow 1.8% in 22. That's less than half of the 3.7% growth they expected in February. And then, as of November, they expected real GDP to decline 0.2% in 23. That has since changed. As I said, the recession got moved largely into 23 and became more mild. So they have a more mild recession. So what they have for 23 now is 0.5% of growth instead of that 0.2% decline. But that says the U.S. economy moves through this mild recession, the unemployment rate rises in the November outlook would rise to 5.7%. Now that's down to 5.1%, but the unemployment rate still comes up, putting pressure or relieving actually some pressure on the labor market. And then IHS expected real GDP to increase 2.7% this year. In February, they expected it to be 2.7% in 23, and the unemployment rate to only average 3.5%. So they expect this recession to be mild by historical standards with a 0.7% peak to trough decline in GDP. That decline is now 0.6%, but it's still a decline. The average pre-Great Recession recessionary decline was 1.7%. So that's what we mean by mild, is that it's a smaller decline in GDP overall. The recovery was forecast to begin in the third quarter of this year. And then they forecast GDP to increase 1.3% in 24, half of the growth rate they expected in February. And they have slower growth projected through the years of our forecast. And that's still true that that growth is lower as of their January outlook. Growth is still lower than it was in February of 22. And then that slow growth in itself creates a risk because when growth is already low, when you have a negative shock, it doesn't take much to kick it into negative territory. The next chart shows inflation. The height of the bars in each case shows annual change in the consumer price index, or the CPI. Throughout 22, we had higher prices, obviously. We ended up with about 8% inflation in 22. That was higher prices for food and rent, and those drove inflation to that 8% level, 3.6 or 3.5 percentage points higher than forecast in February. So a big change from the February 22 outlook. IHS expects slowing demand, consistent with that expected recession, continuing supply chain normalization, and the eventual softening of labor market conditions to slow inflation. So they forecast CPI inflation to fall to 4.3% this year, 2.7% in 24, and then average 2.2% per year in 25 through 27. All those numbers are a little lower in the January forecast than they were in November, but the basic story is still the same, that we have these three steps down of commodity prices and gas prices coming down, supply chain normalization, and labor market softening. The next chart shows the level of the federal funds interest rates. We can talk about monetary policy here. The solid line shows the history. The dotted line shows IHS's February 22 forecast. And the dashed line shows the November 22 expected path. So in response to that higher inflation we saw last year, the Federal Reserve raised its policy rate seven times last year. So it was six times as of the November forecast. And four of those increases were, quote, jumbo increases of 75 basis points. That's a significant acceleration from the path IHS expected a year ago. IHS now expects the Fed to raise its policy rate to just below 5% by March of 23, reverse course in spring of 24, and bring the rate to below 3% in 25. So that's consistent with that expectation that inflation comes in, that inflation settles after 24. In this forecast, those higher interest rates slow business and residential investment, so those interest rate sensitive sectors, and raise the return on Minnesota's general fund cash balances. So that the increased the slowdown in residential investment, that gets reflected in our revenue forecast in the taxes that are tied to the housing market, the deed and mortgage taxes. I'll talk about those in when I get to the revenue slides. The next chart shows U.S. wage and salary income growth. So this is the sum of all the payrolls in the United States. So it's more people, as this grows, it means more people are working or people are making more money per worker or both. And it's growing in this outlook. The light blue bars are the February 22 forecast, and the dark blue bars are the history and the November of 22 forecast. IHS expects the economic slowdown to moderate the U.S. labor market. They forecast U.S. nominal wage income growth of 8.8% in 22, last year, a 0.6 percentage point decrease from the February forecast. And the forecast for wage and salary income has been lowered for years 23 and 24 to 4.0 and 4.1% respectively. And that occurs as the U.S. unemployment rate is expected to rise and stay above 4.5% through our forecast horizon. The next chart, we compare Minnesota to the U.S. with the headline unemployment rate. So this is the overall unemployment rate. The dark line shows Minnesota's unemployment rate. The light line shows the U.S. unemployment rate. The vertical gray bars are U.S. recessions. Minnesota has one of the tightest labor markets in the country. As of October, the unemployment rate was 2.1%, the lowest among states, and 1.6 percentage points below the U.S. rate. As of November, so this chart shows October, as of November, Minnesota's unemployment rate has ticked up to 2.3%, and the U.S. unemployment rate has stayed at 3.7. The unemployment rate, of course, does not capture Minnesotans that have left the labor force, including retirements or those staying home to care for family members. Since the onset of the pandemic in February of 2020, Minnesota's labor force has fallen by 92,000, and the state's labor force participation rate has declined by 2.8 percentage points. Nevertheless, at 68%, Minnesota's labor force participation rate remains high relative to the U.S. It's 5.8 percentage points above the U.S. rate of 62.2%, and it's the fifth highest among U.S. states. So there's a strong demand for workers across the state, with only 4 unemployed job seekers for every 10 job openings. This means that there's less slack in Minnesota's labor market compared to other parts of the country. The next chart shows our forecast for Minnesota employment. This is MMB's forecast for the change in total employment in Minnesota, annual change in total employment. Note that even in the February forecast, so those light blue bars, we were expecting slowing employment growth as tight labor supply limited Minnesota's employers' ability to add jobs. Now, with a mild U.S. recession in the forecast, Minnesota employment growth is expected to slow even further. We expect job gains to decelerate from 3.1% in 22 to 0.3% in 23, 1.2 percentage points slower than we forecast in February. We expect employment to remain flat over 24 as workers who lose jobs are picked up by other employers and growth returns in 25. If you look back to the history, if you note that even in 18 and 19, we had employment growth of less than 1%. And so this labor supply constraint has affected our ability to add jobs even going back that far. I'll turn now to the revenue forecast. The first two columns of the table show our current forecast for the current biennium and the forecast changes since February. And the second two columns show the same thing for the next biennium. As As you know, since February, general fund receipts have significantly exceeded our forecast. So since last February, between February and November, our receipts significantly exceeded our February 22 forecast. Those higher tax receipts at the close of fiscal year 22 and the first part of fiscal year 23 raised the revenue forecast for the current biennium. Total tax revenues for the current biennium are now forecast to be $2.7 billion more than the February forecast. We've raised the forecasts for all three major tax types. For the next biennium, I'm going to focus on that subtotal line for total tax revenues, and then I'll talk about all other revenue. So total tax revenues for the next biennium are now forecast to be $288 million less than the February 22 forecast. Lower forecasts for individual income and other tax revenue offset higher forecasts for sales and corporate taxes. The impact of the expected economic slowdown is seen in the fiscal year 24-25 forecast for individual income tax receipts, which are now expected to be $975 million less than we projected in February. This change is primarily driven by the lower assumed wage income, consistent with that chart I showed you of U.S. wage income growth, and lower forecast growth in non-wage income. In addition, higher inflation increases the amount by which Minnesota income tax brackets are expanded, and that has the effect of lowering the income tax forecast in the next biennium. For both the sales and corporate taxes, a higher base from increased fiscal year 22-23 receipts more than offsets lower forecasts for growth in corporate profits and taxable sales. So we do have lower forecasts for corporate profits and taxable sales, but the base increase from fiscal year from the prior biennium offsets that so that we end up with an increase in the forecast for those taxes. The corporate tax is projected to generate $832 million more revenue than the prior estimate. While we have raised the forecast since February, again, because the starting point is higher, the new forecast actually represents a decline in expected corporate receipts from the prior biennium. So you can see that we were expecting in the prior biennium expecting $5.2 billion in corporate tax receipts. Now it's $4.5 billion in corporate tax receipts. And that occurs as the lower economic forecast creates drag on the corporate sector. Among other tax revenues, the deed transfer and mortgage taxes are both expected to generate less revenue than we forecast in February. That's due to lower refinancing and home sale activity stemming from increased mortgage interest rates. In the table, we've separated out non-tax revenues to show that these sources are now expected to generate significantly more in both biennia than in our February forecast, $564 million more in the prior biennium and $698 million more. I'm sorry, I'm saying the prior biennium, but it's the current biennium. I apologize. So $564 million more in the current biennium and $698 million more in the next biennium. This change is primarily due to an increased forecast for investment income, which is the return the state earns on its cash balances, including the budget reserve. Higher expected interest rates and larger cash balances drive this forecast change. So I've mentioned some of the risks to this forecast. I'm going to summarize those. Inflation poses the most prominent near-term downside risk. Price indices have come in lower than expected in recent months since we prepared our forecast. Nevertheless, if prices do accelerate, then that can cause the Fed to act even more aggressively than they have so far, and that could lower the economic outlook. Moreover, monetary policy works with long and difficult to predict lags. So even if inflation and Fed actions follow the IHS forecast, that path could result in more job losses and lower GDP growth than IHS expects. We talked about the slower long-term growth putting the economy at greater risk for negative shocks. I also want to reiterate that corporate sector and financial markets are volatile and dynamic, and in recent years they have not always behaved in predictable ways. It's difficult to estimate how much aggressive monetary policy and a recession will affect volatile income sources from these sectors, such as corporate profits and capital gains realizations. That ends my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kalmakidis. So we'll go to member question now for all of the presentation we've heard so far, and then we're going to come back to the commissioner to talk a little bit more specifically about the impact of inflation and before we go to the bill hearing, just so folks have a sense of where we're going from here. So Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on page 10, the Minnesota labor market, 92,000 fewer Minnesotans in the labor force in February 2020.
Mm-hmm.
What percentage is that of, like, the round numbers for our normal, sort of normal workforce? Do we have, like, about 3 million people in the workforce?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what percentage, I guess I didn't do the math, but I guess I could. But you're the numbers person. I thought maybe you would know.
It's not. It's a small percentage. I, you know, 92,000 divided by 3 million. I guess I'd have to do the math.
Okay.
Too.
Representative Scott.
That's it. Thank you.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Kalambrakidis, you talked about the recession not being long or deep. Uh-huh. So how will that impact the rating? As you recall, in 2022, since 2003, Minnesota now has got AAA from all the credit rating agencies.
Oh.
How will that impact our credit rating compared to the revenue and everything else that we have?
Dr. Kalambrakidis.
Okay, so let me make sure I understand, Madam Chair, representative members of the committee. Let me make sure I understand the question. So the U.S. recession that is forecast is mild. It could be longer and deeper if there are additional negative shocks, if monetary policy doesn't work the way expected. Is that, and you're asking me what happens to our credit rating if the recession is worse than what is expected here. Is that, do I have that right?
Representative Knorr.
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative, the rating agencies have been giving us credit, so to speak, for the fact that we have a diverse economy, meaning we have employment distributed across a wide range of industries that looks a lot like the U.S. economy. In that regard, they've given us credit for our financial management for the state, for governance, for the budget reserve policy. All of those things will still be true. All those persistent assets for Minnesota are going to be true even if we hit a deeper recession. The agencies will be watching what happens to revenues, and so they will be concerned about in a deep recession how far our revenues go down and what that means for financial management and for the government's ability to fund services. But the persistent assets of the economy, including the diverse economy, educated workforce, and the persistent assets of financial management in the state, those will stay the same even if we hit a worse recession.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I attended a luncheon not too long ago, just a few days ago, actually, women in business, and the demographer had come, the state demographer, and she had said we had 167,000 job vacancies. And we talked a little bit about immigration and migration, and I'm just wondering, related to that, about our high school graduates going somewhere else for college and then not returning.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you could just give us a little bit of understanding as to how many folks that are, and are we seeing a trend, either increase or decrease, in the return of our students back to Minnesota?
Dr. Kalambrakidis.
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee, that level of detail is something that the state demographer can answer and not me, in terms of she's the one who knows how that in and out migration is happening across age groups. So I know what you know, which is that she says that people go, we lose people on net in those college age years. And so that's an opportunity for the state to try to attract those back. And then I can also say that our forecast is consistent with her projections. So when we do the February forecast, we will be visiting with the demographer's projections on that. So I don't know what the projections are for how those age group in and out migrations might change going forward.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we do have the chair of higher ed in here, and I hope that as we start our higher ed hearings that we do talk about that, trying to bring those students back, because that is a huge brain suck away from Minnesota. These are some of the most, the top students that we're losing to other states, and they're not returning. And unfortunately, if you look at the entire Midwest, I was at another meeting, and we're the only one in like five states around that are actually have a net loss. Everybody else is gaining. So they're either gaining our students or they're doing a better job. But it's something I think if we have 167,000 job vacancies today, that we need to do a better job. I was just curious if you happen to know the trends, and maybe, Madam Chair, if that's something that, are we going to have the state demographer come in and talk about some of that level detail?
Representative O'Neill, we weren't planning on that, and I don't know what other committee chairs may be doing relevant to their budget areas to consider, but I think it's noted that we've heard that from a few members here today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And first of all, I was remiss in not saying this earlier. I just want to, it's nice to have everybody in the same room. It's just really nice to have that, except for Representative Howard. I don't want him there. It's nice to see the people you work with and be able to look. Madam Chair and the testifier, at the federal level, the federal government continues to borrow annually in excess of $1 trillion. It's not a partisan comment. I mean, Trump spent money like a Democrat. It doesn't seem like it really, it doesn't really matter who wins the election at the federal level. They continue just to borrow trillions of dollars. On a scale of 1 to 100 from an economic perspective, how concerned should Minnesotans be about the lack of budgetary discipline at the federal level?
Dr. Komagidis.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that it's a concern. It's one of the reasons why. So there are two reasons why the Congressional Budget Office for as long as I've been state economist, which is 10 years, and I've been watching this, they have had lower, CBO has had lower expected U.S. growth in the out years, so in the long term. And the two reasons for that are the baby boom aging out of the workforce, which we are in the middle of that. That's part of Minnesota's challenge right now, and federal debt. And that eventually that federal debt creates a drag in the economy. So eventually it creates a drag. What is fascinating is that it's not at all clear when that happens and how, at what point the debt gets big enough to create more of a drag on the economy. We have seen the global economies and the U.S. macroeconomy behave in ways that wouldn't have been predicted based on the macro that I learned in graduate school. So we know that there are structural changes in the macroeconomy. But yes, it's a concern and it's a reason for slower growth as you look further out.
Representative Groff.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to the testifier. And in addition, a significant portion of our national debt is financed short term. And so as interest rates rise, it would seem that we have begun to enter this process of increasing spikes because of our debt service on a growing debt base is increasing. Is that an additional concern that's happening? And again, not a partisan comment for President Biden. It doesn't seem like any of these clowns out there care about the budget deficit at all. Do you have any? Is that fair to say that interest rates are actually adding fuel to the fire?
Dr. Komagidis.
Madam Chair, Representative, members of the committee. Yes. That's part of the concern. So we are one of these structural changes, things that we're trying to figure out now, is that we had these decade of very low inflation, very low interest rates, and a record length economic expansion. And that ended with COVID. Yep. And COVID created structural changes in the labor market that we do not understand yet. And interest rates are up, and inflation is high, and these are things that we have not dealt with for a long time. So I would say yes, these are concern. And you're highlighting one of the important differences between the way the state operates and the way the federal government operates, is that the state balances its budget, and so the state can't do this deficit financed spending that the federal government does. And so when there is a need for spending. The federal government can do that deficit finance spending. The state can't, and that can help the economy recover from something like COVID, but there are consequences for it as well, costs.
Chair, the analogy I make is that, you know, it's Saturday night. There's an open bar right now during this legislative session. No one wants to talk about last call, and no one certainly wants to talk about the hangover that's coming tomorrow morning. But a lot of the macro factors we're having in our economy are being driven by unsustainable patterns of financial behavior at the federal level on a bipartisan basis. So, but no one wants to talk about that. Everyone wants to go up to the bar and have another drink. So.
Great. So we have two more members on the list, and then we're going to continue on with Commissioner Showalter and then move to the bill hearing. So we'll do the two members that are on the list, and then we'll continue on. So Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, you know, this is one of those committees, and especially this presentation, where it's really easy for us to stay up here in our, like, big thinking brains where we talk about recessions and percentages and all these things and all these charts. And I just wanted to... the thing that really stood out for me is this 4 workers for every 10 jobs and what that means for Minnesotans and real people. And it means that, you know, we don't have the number of people taking care of our loved ones, whether that's folks struggling with mental illness or addiction or our elders, all those folks, whether it's our kids in our schools. And I just wanted to just for a second, like, ground us in what that means in real life for people in our communities when we have the unemployment rate where it is right now with that many openings. And it also means that, you know, a lot of these caring jobs and school jobs, those things are all dictated by where other spending happens and what the federal rates of reimbursement are. And so they don't even have the option in a lot of these places where we're caring for people, where you can just start paying them more. That just isn't an option, and the reality is that folks are really struggling. So it's, you know, it's an interesting figure on a chart, but I just kind of wanted to call out what that means for folks in the real world of the people that we're serving here in these jobs. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a couple quick responses to things I've heard here today. One, a comment about Trump spending like a Democrat. I have to say that I don't think Trump spent like a Democrat because he spent on rich people, and we know that that doesn't help the economy, like spending on average people and low-income people, which is what Democrats tend to do. The other thing I just would like to sort of mention here is that I suspect that in coming years we're going to see a change in population dynamics because of reproductive freedom. From what I hear is that young people who are in those ages where they might, in fact, have pregnancies really might want to be in a place where should something happen that they're not expecting, that they can be able to deal with it in the privacy of their own situation with their own medical provider. And there might be changes in immigration in and out of the state, perhaps, I would say in, based on that. I don't know if Dr. Kolomakidis has any information. This is probably purely speculative because we really haven't seen it yet, but from what I hear from people, if you have a choice, sometimes you want to be where you know that if something happens, like you have a miscarriage, and you don't want to go to the doctor and have them worry about whether they're going to be thrown in jail for helping you.
Dr. Kolomakidis, you have a quick response.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, I think that is one of the structural landscape changes that has happened in the labor market and in the business world. Among other things that COVID changed, that has been a huge change, and you're right, we haven't yet seen what the impact of that will be.
So we are going to move on. I see Representative Plowski, you have you. So we're going to do the commissioner's piece on, in just speaking, we're going to hear the House File 35. We'll have more of a discussion around that bill and inflation. But I did ask the commissioner just to talk more generally ahead of that to give us a sense of how inflation impacts the state budget. So we'll have him do that. And Representative Plowski, I'll go to you at that point. So Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start with the last slide of this presentation, which is the long-term budget outlook. And so it's probably a good jumping-off place for inflation because, as you know, inflation is not included in the forecast in a general measure. What you see here is the 24 and 25 and 26, 27 estimated revenues and spending. Looking at the comparison of those on a real-time basis, or like how do those line up on any given period of time, you'll see that we maintain a structural balance in both of those periods with growth in both of them. One of the things that is not included in that is the effect of inflation on any of those sets of numbers generally. For general inflation, we're estimating about $1.6 billion in the current in the budget biennium and about 3.3 in the tails based upon a CPI. And applying that really only to the parts of the budget that don't have inflation in it. I should say that there's parts of the forecast that do have inflation in it. So things like nursing facility payments, property tax refunds, special ed. There are statutory notes about what inflation is and how those work together. And there's other parts where it wouldn't make any sense, like debt service payments, where it is a dollar amount that we are to pay out. That said, those are the estimated inflations for those periods of time. Now, the part that is less clear is that in the budget period, there is also the effect of inflation, but we have a budget in place. So at this point, you know, the highest parts of the inflation were, in fact, in 22 and 23. We are seeing estimated inflation in this forecast around 7% in 22 and about 6.6% in 23. And so there are pressures on the existing budget that's on the table that are not accounted for in these estimated inflations. So that isn't part of what we're saying here, but I just want to point out that the inflation was certainly part of the backdrop of looking at agency budget recommendations and sort of considering where we're going forward, simply because that is to be managed inside the appropriations that the legislature enacts and doesn't really carry forward or show up as an automatic factor going forward. So, Chair Olson, that's kind of the wrap-up of this presentation, and happy to go further or take questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Pawlowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to make a reference to comments that have been made. And my first reference is this, that every high school senior in this state should have the option of graduating not just with a traditional diploma, but with an employable skill set. In the October 2019 mini session, the largest hearing was at the Technical College. As a result of that hearing, legislation was passed in June of 2021 that for the first time in three decades, we are going to have licensure and certification of what we once called vocational ed teachers, but what we will call now technical education teachers that can go back into our high schools and teach high school seniors a skill set so that when they graduate, they will be employable. I've had one conversation with the chair of K-12 education on this already, and hopefully if we have a joint hearing, the scope of that hearing will be the relinking of our two-year technical colleges, which were once vocational schools inside our school districts. Now they will be a technical college linked to our high schools so that those high school seniors, and I think it's about 40% of the population, can get an employable skill set upon graduation. That's one way to address the problem that we have with finding employable individuals, and it's another to say that you can graduate with an employable skill set without debt, and hopefully they will stay in the area that they are graduating in. And they might even, Madam Chair, be able to afford a family, maybe a home, and other things as a result of not having that debt. So the scope of the Higher Education Committee this session is going to be focused at least partially on accomplishing that end.
Thank you, Representative Pawlowski. Great. Sounds like our chairs have a lot of work to do to dig into all of this, and we have great people for the job. So thank you for all of that. And so I want to say thank you to the Commissioner, thank you to the State Budget Director, thank you to Dr. Colmakidis. And the Commissioner is going to stick around. Your team will be around as we proceed to the next portion of the meeting, which is the bill hearing. So thank you all very much for being here in person after so many years on Zoom doing this. And we're really glad you were here. And with all the juggling of schedules, appreciate your flexibility with that. So thank you. And will they exit the testifier table and I call up Representative Stevenson, I'm going to actually go back to our minutes and have Vice Chair Edelson move the minutes from, it was
January.
You have the January 5th minutes, 2023. Will you make a motion to move those minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Can I get a second?
Second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. And so with that, Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. And being you are not on this committee, I will move your bill for you. So I move that House File 35 be re-referred to the General Register. So Representative Stevenson, thank you. And with that, you can proceed with presenting your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a relatively straightforward bill to correct a 20-year error, in my view, in which we have included inflation on one side of our budget forecasting, but not the other side. And I just want you to imagine if you were a family engaged in the kind of forecasting and budgeting that we have been doing for 20 years at the state, what would happen. If you had started the year in 2022, sitting at the family table thinking about how you're putting your family budget together, and you assumed that you would get a salary increase commensurate with inflation, but also assumed that everything else that you were spending money on in your family budget, your food, your energy, your housing, would all remain the same cost throughout the year of 2022, by the time you got to December, you would be in a world of pain. Because as we know, inflation has really real impacts on our budgets. So what this bill is about is honest accounting, reflecting inflation on both sides of the budget forecast, and getting rid of the kind of budgetary gimmicks that Minnesotans really don't like. A couple of sort of, I don't want to call them technical notes, but things that I think are important to highlight. First, there is a fiscal note attached to this bill of some significance. It reflects $1.5 billion in the upcoming biennium and $3.3 in the tails. But I want to note that that is just simply reflecting the impact on the projected surplus on once you account for inflation. This bill doesn't actually cost us anything, nor does it appropriate any money, and that's reflected in the fiscal note. There's no administrative cost to this bill. The fiscal note just reflects that if we adopted this methodology, that the November forecast would have reflected a budget surplus that was, you know, roughly $1.5 billion less in the upcoming biennium and roughly $3.3 billion less in the tails. The other thing is that I think it's really important to note that this is a forward-looking bill. That is, that we're really looking at adding inflation, accounting for the inflation that will occur in fiscal years 24 and 25, and not accounting for the impact on our budget for the inflation that occurred in 2022, 2023, and prior years, which is not incorporated into our forecasts, and that chairs will have to think about as they are making their budgetary decisions going forward. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions from the committee.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if you could give us a little bit of a history as far as why this hasn't been included in the past, or if it had been, you know, 20, 30 years ago before we were all here. Well, most of us. There's a member or two here that might have been. But if that change had happened, and if so, if it hadn't happened, why we're looking at doing it now where we hadn't done it in the past.
Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Neill. Well, when this change was adopted, when we excluded inflation from the budget forecast, I was a senior in high school wishing that I had the kind of deployable skills that Representative Pawlowski is going to make sure that I have going forward in life. My understanding, though, of the situation is that we had a budget deficit. We were in a period of sort of the beginning of chronic budget deficits, and one way that we could make the numbers add up, particularly in the tails, was by removing inflation from the forecast on the expenditure side. And that's why I refer to it as a budgetary gimmick. Before that time period, for a decade before that time period, we did include inflation in the budget forecast, and I think it was a more honest way of looking at our budget.
Representative O'Neill. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author, too. So I used to create budgets for the church. It's a large congregation as well. And one of the things when we looked at expense budgets, we can do a couple of different things. One is the budget is about how much we spend, not necessarily about how much things cost. And so what you're suggesting is that we automatically build in how much things are going to cost rather than understanding that the budget reflects how much money we want to spend. And what a budget does is it determines that if we're going to spend, say, $100,000 on a particular project, if the costs come in, we got to find ways of reducing that. Not necessarily that we automatically increase that budget, because that then takes away kind of the responsibility of those that oversee the budget and those that actually propose the budget as to how they are going to be looking at savings in those particular areas. And so I think your initial discussion about how it's not proper for us to say, hey, things are going to cost more, so therefore we got to automatically increase the budget in order to do that, is probably a little bit one-sided and doesn't take into the effect the responsibility of those that are setting that particular budget to understand it. So I'm just saying, I think that's something that you maybe overlooked. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Petersburg. Well, I think it's important to clarify the difference between a budget and a forecast. And what we're talking about today is putting it into the forecast document. It doesn't spend any money, so there's no automatic increase in spending. What we're trying to look at is if we want to continue doing what we've been doing for the last 2 years, and maybe we don't, but that's the forecast. If we're going to continue on the same path, this is how much it would cost. And that way we can make an honest decision, and we can look at, do we want to continue spending that? But the forecast doesn't appropriate any dollars. It is not a budget. That is what the legislature does. MMB gives us a projection that allows us to informs our decision making here. And I think it should be an honest projection that accounts for all of the economic variables. I'm not aware of any business or church that would look at a year going forward as they're going through their budgetary process and just say, we're going to assume for the next year that everything's going to cost the exact same. And as I said at the outset, if you did that, you'd end up in a lot of trouble. You really need to account for inflation when you're making these decisions. And our forecast documents, which give us the information upon which we build our budget, should reflect the very real reality of inflation.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm just saying that we have gotten to the point where forecasts oftentimes reflect budget. And so to say that we aren't going to use it for a budget basis, I think is maybe a little bit directly unrelated to what actually happens. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while I disagree with the bill, I do think Representative Stevenson is right when he says that this bill doesn't spend any money. It's just a matter of what you use for baseline assumptions. If you're somebody who wants to assume that you want to put your thumb on the scale to have government spend more money or make more investments or grow more, then you should vote in favor of Representative Stevenson's bill. If you're someone who wants to have a more skeptical budget eye towards things and you want to approve things on a dollar by dollar basis, then you should oppose Representative Stevenson's bill. But I do think if you look at the, and again, Representative Stevenson laid this out in the fiscal note that even though there's dollars listed, that money is not appropriated, right? It's not actually given. But if you want to know why DFLers tend to be in favor of this, take a look at what the estimates are in the biennial total. Fiscal years 24 and 25, there's a $1.5 billion increase in presumed increase in spending. The next 2 years, there's an increase of $3.3 billion. Now, how does that make any sense when we see that our economic forecasts for projected rates of inflation are actually flat going forward? And it's because what it does is it puts a presumption of spending, a presumption of increasing, and if that's what you want, then that's what you should vote for. Again, that's not what I believe in, and I would ask people to vote no on the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to say that, you know, the opposite of that also pertains here, which is that I, for example, for years have felt that when we do the way we do our forecasts misleads Minnesotans makes them think that we have more so-called extra money than we really do. So if you want to be pretending that you're actually funding things and making it possible for all the areas that we fund to actually do the things we want them to do and keep doing that and pretend that we're not really shorting them and asking them to do more with less, then vote no. But if you want to be honest, I think as Representative Stevenson was saying, I think this is a very important, very reasonable bill, and I would ask everyone to vote for it. Thank you.
final word to your bill, Representative Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for considering the bill. I just do want to stress that if this bill passed, the legislature will still have to budget on a dollar-by-dollar basis. This does not appropriate any money, and scrutiny can and should be placed by the legislature on every single appropriation, and this bill doesn't change that. It's just making sure we start with information that is honest and accurate, and so I ask for a yes vote.
Thank you. So with that, I renew the motion that House File 35 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 35 is re-referred to the General Register. And with that, members, we have no further business, and we do not have a meeting next week at our regularly scheduled time on the 16th. We'll be back here on the 23rd at 10:30, but of course, if things come up, we can always call this meeting. But with that, we are adjourned.